This is a podcast from the Fitzwilliam Museum, Cambridge.
My name's John Brooke. I've taught at the University of Oxford until my retirement 2 or 3 years ago. I was the first occupant of a chair in science and religion. I'm basically a historian of science. I have written on Darwin in the past, and therefore it's been a particular joy to see this exhibition. And what I want to say, first of all, I think, is that one of the things that makes it so wonderful is that it is an aesthetic experience in itself, just to look at the many beautiful forms that are on display. One that caught my eye was the cage of the hummingbirds that belonged to John Gould and which have been described as gems of nature. I didn't realise that he owned 5,400 hummingbirds till I read the museum catalogue. But these are just objects of stunning beauty, as are the birds of paradise, which I think one also just stares at with amazement when one encounters them in the exhibition. I also loved the botanical plates of John Henslow, who was one of Darwin's key mentors, of course, here in Cambridge. Sometimes the question's asked if Darwin had gone to Oxford rather than Cambridge, whether we would have had a theory of evolution. And it's a very tricky question, because in Oxford he would have met other scientists, like the geologist William Buckland, for example. But John Henslow was a really key figure who arranged for Darwin to go on the Beagle Voyage. And that, of course, was absolutely crucial for the development of Darwin's theory. The whole exhibition, I think, makes one think much more deeply about the fascinating relationship between nature and art. There's been a long tradition in the history of Western science of trying to imitate nature. And this was always a problematic issue, because in the ancient philosophy of Aristotle, there was a very sharp distinction between nature and art. And if the human artist tried to copy nature in some way, it was assumed that one would fail. Alchemy is a very good example of that. I was originally a historian of chemistry, and the alchemists used to try to make gold from the base metals. But there was always the question, was it real gold or was it simply an imitation? And a crucial development took place in the 17th century when nature became mechanized. Nature became a great mechanism. In a way, nature became the art of the creator. And that artistry was rather like the art of a clockmaker. And when Darwin was in Cambridge, he would have read the works of William Paley, who specifically develops that analogy between the natural world and a piece of clockwork. And of course, if you accept that view, then it was very easy to argue for design in nature, because clocks and machines don't spring up by themselves. But the wonderful thing about Darwin's theory, of course, is that it gives us a very different image of a non-static nature. It's a dynamic nature. And Darwin reacts against that notion that everything has been meticulously designed. Geology, of course, had changed the perspective on the world before Darwin published his book, and I was very glad to see in the exhibition the painting by William Dyce of Pegwell Bay, where one has that image of human figures dwarfed by the cliffs and dwarfed by enormous eons of time. There's a comet right at the top of the picture, Donati's comet. And when William Dyce painted that picture, he gave the picture a very specific date to indicate that the comet would have been visible on that date. So both through astronomy and through geology, you do get that sense of a dynamic world, one that's changed. It's not the clockwork universe of William Paley. But before Darwin, it was still possible to look at the fossil forms and see evidence of beauty and artistry in those. There's a very interesting example in the Scottish geologist Hugh Miller, who died in 1857, just before Darwin published. Hugh Miller was very struck by the way in which fossil forms were themselves forms of architecture. So art and architecture are linked to the study of nature. And Miller argued very interestingly, actually, that when humans do their architecture, when they build big cathedrals, often the structures you find are very similar to those we find in the organic forms in the fossil record. So he was able to argue that human beings and God share the same aesthetic sensibilities, because God designed the creatures whose fossilized remains we see, and we construct very similar kind of things in our architecture. But this is where the really striking contrast with Darwin comes, and I think the exhibition brings this out magnificently, because on his theory of sexual selection, Darwin, of course, is arguing that we share the same aesthetic sensibilities with birds, not so much with God. And this brings everything down to the natural level. And I think the exhibition is really brilliant on this. When one looks at questions of the wonderful colouring of bird plumage and questions of bird song too, on the Darwinian theory, you can no longer say that these beautiful features of creation were made specifically for us to enjoy. The beautiful tail of the peacock or the Argus pheasant are for the birds, not for us. It just so happens we also find them extremely beautiful. And I have to say, I think one of the most vivid images in the whole exhibition is the dynamic one, where we get that lovely little video of the male Argus pheasant trying to win over the female and having to work very, very hard. She just doesn't seem interested at all. There's an aspect of this story which takes me back to some work I did a few years ago on the 19th century female advocate of education, Mary Somerville, who was a great popularizer of science. And one of her reactions to Darwin's theory is very, very interesting, because she makes the point that before Darwin, one could look at beauty in nature and see it as there for human benefit. And she points out that the Darwinian theory produces a change of perspective on these questions. And she actually points out that there are many women in the world who like to ornament themselves and make themselves sexually more attractive by putting the feathers of birds in their hats. And she actually protests about this and says this is not the way we should treat the rest of the animal creation. So that's a rather interesting female reaction to Darwin, but one which actually led to the protest that women should not be using these wonderfully coloured feathers in their hats. There's another bird image in the exhibition which I found particularly striking. That's Dean Wollstoneholme's depiction of a pouter pigeon. And it's such a beautiful image, and it reminds one, of course, of what a crucial role pigeons played in Darwin's argument in The Origin of Species, because he could argue that even a well-trained ornithologist, looking at all the different varieties of pigeon that humans had managed to breed, even a well-trained ornithologist would think of them as belonging to different species unless they already knew that they were descended from the common rock pigeon. And, of course, Darwin uses that as an analogy for what nature can do over an enormous period of time, producing new forms that really are new species because of gradual change over enormous periods of time. So many images in the exhibition capture the most revolutionary aspect of Darwin's theory, which is, of course, the continuity between the animal world and humans, which was so shocking to the sensibilities of many of his contemporaries. I think the most powerful image here, and the one on which I spent quite a long time when I first entered the exhibition, is that wonderful sculpture of Hugo Reingold showing the ape contemplating the skull of a man. And that's wonderful because the ape is depicted as having a kind of intelligence, almost a kind of empathetic understanding of the human skull that he has in his hands. It's immediately shocking as an image because it's a complete inversion of what one would expect. It's not the human holding the skull of the animal and contemplating its significance. It's the other way around. And I thought that was a brilliant stroke to place that at the very forefront of the exhibition. There's another image from the 19th century which isn't actually in the exhibition, but it's another case where animals are contemplating a human skull. It's one of Henry de la Beech's caricatures of the geology of Charles Lyell. And it's significant because what you actually see there is an ichthyosaur, which has returned to the earth after human beings have become extinct. So the professor Ichthyosaurus is holding the human skull in his hand, calling into question how humans even managed to survive at all with such minute teeth. So it's a rather interesting motif, this, of the way human skulls are imagined, held, and reflected on by the animal world. Darwin's message was, of course, that once a creature was extinct, it wouldn't ever come back, and that would apply to Ichthyosaurus and it would apply to human beings. And it reminds one of the tragedy of our current situation, where it's we who are doing the extinguishing, and that so many species are becoming extinct in our own time. I mentioned Henry de la Beech and that image of the Ichthyosaurus contemplating the human skull. There is actually a Henry de la Beech present in the exhibition through the coloured representation by Robert Farron of a primeval scene where everything is eating everything else. This is in the Durea Antiquior. And it's deeply unsettling. It was deeply unsettling to one of Darwin's contemporaries, the Reverend Charles Kingsley, because how could you possibly prove God's existence or believe in a beneficent God in a world where everything is eating everything else? It's a very disconcerting thing to have to face. And what Kingsley says is if you have a very strongly held belief in the existence of God, and he certainly did, then you can reconcile that kind of image with divine purposes. But if you don't, then it is a disturbing picture. So I was just making that point that these images of nature red in tooth and claw were a very potent force, expressed in that form, of course, by Tennyson before Darwin published. Because of my own interest in the bearing of Darwin on religious thinking, I'm always fascinated by images which bear on that theme. And it was nice to see the portrait cove in the Beagle Channel as represented by Conrad Martens, because it showed the Fuegians, who made a huge impression on Darwin when he visited that southern tip of South America. Seeing the Fuegians gesticulating on the shoreline, he said, was one of the most amazing sights he'd ever seen and one that he would never forget. And we have to remember, of course, one of the questions he started asking when he saw the Fuegians was, were our ancestors men like these? And he would compare the Fuegians with orangutans in the wild. You can see him making those historical connections, raising other questions too, of course, about how thin is the veneer of our civilization imposed on the top of such similarities. Another image which caught my eye, and rather surprisingly, was Monet's painting of Rouen Cathedral in that series of the many he did of the facade of the cathedral. And I was struck by what was said in the little panel accompanying that picture, because it implies that Monet was somehow treating the cathedral more like a geological formation than a cathedral expressing a Christianity with which apparently he had very little sympathy. I'd not myself ever made connections between Darwin and the Impressionists, so this is an interesting example where the exhibition has actually set me thinking, and I really want to do a little bit more work on that myself and to investigate it further. In the Monet, if that interpretation is correct, what one is seeing is art reflecting new scientific temperaments and sensibilities. But perhaps as one final comment, I was particularly struck by the realization that there were respects in which the art could directly depict the science. And I was thinking here particularly of Abbot Teo's representation of the peacock's tail, where the tail is placed against an environment in which it almost becomes invisible. And this was his attempt to demonstrate a particular theory, which was that the development of these beautiful and colourful forms are all to do with camouflage. They're not to do with sexual selection. So there's that very nice tension between what Darwin had proposed and what Teo depicts in that picture. But it is a direct translation of his science into art, and I found that extremely interesting.